cuffs clanked as he shrugged. I knew what was coming. I wasn't wrong.
I want a lawyer, said Connor Grant, the madman who no longer appeared insane.
He looked me in the eye and smiled. He was still smiling when his guards yanked him out of his chair and took him back to his cell. Chapter 12. Brady and I returned to the squad room, both of us looking like we had been knocked out in the first round. I was mortified. I thought Brady felt even worse. He said,
I shouldn't have lost it.
Nothing would have worked.
Something has to.
He stomped off to his office. I stopped at the front of the room and looked up at the TV hanging from the ceiling, tilted so that everyone in the squad room had a good view. Even though the sound was off, the pictures spoke without using words. Thousands of people were banked outside the barricades on the Embarcadero that had been set up to preserve the crime scene. Some in the crowd held up hastily scrawled drawings of broken hearts. The camera panned across the grieving faces to the charred remains of Citron. The headline across the top of the screen was, Another Gar Strike? Was Gar responsible? Or were they taking responsibility for a bomb not their own? Had Gar inspired Connor Grant? Or did we have the wrong freaking freak in a cell in the sixth floor jail? I left the TV and walked toward the corner Rich and I had co-opted, equidistant from the entrance to the squad room and the window with its view of Bryant Street. Our desks faced each other, and Rich looked up when I slung my jacket over the back of my chair. He was on the phone, but he said,
Hold on, please,
and put his hand over the mouthpiece.
You okay?
He asked. I shrugged, said, Be right back, and headed into the break room. When I looked up, Rich was standing with me at the coffee maker, watching me pour a mug of mud with a shaky hand.
What happened in there?
He asked. Typical dirtbag, I told him. He recanted his confession, or whatever you call what he told me and Joe. Said I needed to clean out my ears. He didn't do it, didn't bomb anything, of course. And he lawyered up, the bastard. Conklin said,
You sure you want coffee?
I want something, I said. I'm going to run over to the hospital for a couple hours. Two of Joe's brothers are just coming in from New York. I'm going to meet them there.
Stay as long as you want, he said. We can't get into Grant's place until after the bomb squad clears it.
I took three sips of coffee, dumped the rest into the sink, and rinsed out the cup. I said, Rich, what if I hadn't seen Grant standing there on the sidewalk beaming at his masterpiece? We'd have less than nothing, and the feds would be working this case.
True.
Is Grant having a good laugh at the SFPD? Or is he for real? I'd really like to know.
If he did it, we'll nail him,
Conklin said. Then,
Linz, did you see the message from Claire? She wants to see you ASAP.
Did she say why?
Hell no.
Okay, then. I got my jacket and headed out. Chapter 13. Dr. Claire Washburn is the city's chief medical examiner and my closest friend. I needed to see her, too. The most direct path from homicide to the ME's office is out the lobby's rear entrance and 100 yards down the breezeway toward Harriet Street. I was on total autopilot until I opened the double doors to the ME's office. I didn't recognize the guy behind the reception desk. This wasn't so unusual. On account of overexposure to death and no opportunity for advancement, Claire's receptionists tended to turn over every couple of months of their own accord. The new receptionist was middle-aged, male, wearing a jacket and tie. He had folded a sheet of paper into a nameplate and written Gregory Mark Peters. I badged Gregory, introduced myself, and said, Dr. Washburn asked to see me. There were about 8 cops and as many civilians in the waiting room, all of them waiting to see Claire. Gregory said, She's awfully busy right now, Sergeant. Why don't you take a seat? I gave him a look that could bore through stone. Hit the buzzer, I said. He did it. I strong-armed the glass door, marched past Claire's office, and went directly into the autopsy suite. I found Claire gloved up, gowned, masked, and bloodied, leaning over a body on the autopsy table. She dropped her scalpel into a bowl, stripped off her gloves, and said to her assistant, Bunny, I'm taking a 5-minute break. She put a hand on my waist and walked me to her office, then settled in behind her desk as I took the chair across from her. Claire is African-American, bosomy, and warm-hearted. Although how she manages warmth when she performs or oversees 1,200 autopsies a year is kind of a mystery. She said, "I can't stop thinking about Joe. How's he doing?" I had called her while I was waiting for Joe to reappear from his trip into Cytron and again from the hospital, but I updated her now. His doctor tells me it's still too soon to know.
"I'm so sorry about this, Lens. But he's going to pull through. It's Joe we're talking about."
I took a deep breath and said, "One minute he's raising his glass to happy days. Next minute..." I put my hands over my eyes, breathing deeply, willing myself not to cry. When I looked up, my friend was watching me with deep concern. She reached over the desk and grabbed my hands.
"Let me know how I can help. I can call the doctor, look at film, go with you to the hospital, whatever you need. Anything."
"Thanks, Claire. Very much." I gave her Dr. Dalrymple's card and she put it next to her phone. I said, "You wanted to talk to me?"
"Yeah, well, obviously we're full up here and overflowing.
But something rare came in last night, and I need to tell you about it." "Go ahead."
"A 40-year-old white woman in nice clothes was found in the street just off the Embarcadero and brought in with the blast victims. She had some bruises that make me think she was hit by a car, but not the kinds of lacerations people got who were inside Cytron or close to it. Her handbag was missing," Claire said, "so no ID. I thought she'd died from cardiac arrest. That scene last night could cause some people to have a heart attack, you know."
"Don't I ever. I did the post. Her heart was perfect, Lindsay. She had a stroke, maybe? Or an aneurysm?"
"Before I went there, something was nagging at me. I gave her another external exam, found something that reminded me of a case that came in a few months back."
"Don't stop now," I said.
"She had a nice bruise on her left hip and a scrape on her arm, probably got bumped by a car. This wasn't fatal, but there was a puncture wound on her right buttock centered on a bruise the size of a quarter. I have seen a nearly identical puncture and bruise once before."
Claire had my attention, but I felt urgently that I had to get into my car and switch on the sirens. I needed to get to the hospital. I had to meet with Joe's brothers. I had to see Joe. I said,
"What are you saying, Claire?" "I've sent out the victim's blood. I'll know more soon. Right now, I'm calling her manner of death undetermined. But what I'm thinking is that this nice-looking lady was killed. That her death was a homicide."
Chapter 14. After an emotionally wrenching meeting with Joe's brothers at my husband's bedside, I cried all the way back to the hall. I washed my face, reset my ponytail, then I joined Conklin for a meeting in Brady's office. It was a tough transition. I was still with Joe, not knowing if he would slip away before I saw him again. At the same time, I was needed here and now. Brady was keyed up and focused. He had taped up an enlargement of Cytron's final moments on the wall facing his desk where he could see it all the time. He offered us chairs, booted up his computer, and pulled up the video of our interrogation of Connor Grant that morning. The three of us watched it together, looking for something we'd missed. Something we should have asked. We strained for something useful or revealing. Straining through the nothing Grant had given us for any kind of lead. Brady said,
"One more time."
He reversed the video, hit play. We watched again. Then we kicked it around for a while, concluding that based on our combined decades of cop experience and gut instinct, the science teacher was not a team player. He was a textbook megalomaniac working alone. That said, we'd all been wrong before. Did he do it? No idea. Meeting over, Conklin and I headed out at high speed through Bayview, a gentrifying mixed-use area that was once home to Candlestick Park, currently home to Connor Grant, our suspected mass murderer. I hardly spoke as Rich drove us toward Grant's house on Jamestown Avenue. I was thinking about having seen Joe, being with his devastated brothers. We had tried to buck one another up, but it hadn't worked. Joe was still deep in the woods without a compass. He could die. Our daughter would lose her father, and I would never be able to forgive myself for not making peace with my husband while I had the chance. Conklin's voice broke into my thoughts.
Lynn's up ahead on the right.
Behind a thicket of law enforcement vehicles, positioned between two old cinder block buildings and sitting far back on its lot, was a tidy blue wood frame house with white trim. Conklin parked in the midst of the cruisers, and as he turned off the engine, there was a knock on the glass. CSI Director Charlie Clapper was standing between his car and ours, bending down to say hello. Clapper is a former homicide cop and one of SFPD's most valuable players. As always, he was well-dressed, jacket, no tie, his salt-and-pepper hair slicked back, and his expression showed that he was itching to get into the house. The three of us stood in the sunshine as the bomb squad did their work, and we talked about the monstrous incident on Pier 15, the numbers of dead and seriously wounded, including Joe. I told Clapper that Joe was still in a medically induced coma, but holding his own in the ICU. A door slammed, and I looked toward the house to see three bomb squad techs in full protective gear come outside. One of them pushed up his face shield and signaled a thumbs up.
All clear, said Clapper. Let's go.
Chapter 15. Grant's house wasn't a crime scene, but Clapper's techs treated it that way. It was a potentially invaluable source of evidence, and they would be comparing traces from the house with whatever they could scrape off Pier 15. They took pictures, lifted prints, and swabbed hard surfaces. When they'd covered a room and moved on to the next, Conklin and I stepped in. We were looking for something tangible that would crash Grant's cat-and-mouse game, a manifesto, a foreign flag, GAR-related or any radical literature, a blueprint of Citron, a thread to follow. Proof of something either to force a confession out of Grant or to blow up his fanciful story. Conklin went upstairs and I went through the cramped living room, frisking the TV console and the bookshelves. Grant had the complete DVD collections of Law and Order and The Sopranos. His books were nonfiction, subjects ranging from ancient civilization to law, architecture, art history, military weapons, and of course, everything you ever wanted to know about bombs. He also had about 50 biographies of artists, writers, and politicians, none of them seditious. The guy had a wide range of deep interests. The laptop in the office would be taken back to the forensics lab, but meanwhile, I checked out his stack of unopened mail on the credenza with my gloved hand. I found bills, flyers, assorted catalogs for school chemistry supplies. I flipped through the catalogs and saw only consumer-grade beakers and microscopes for sale in bulk amounts. Conklin came down the stairs, saying to me,
Second floor has two bedrooms and a bath. One of the bedrooms is in active use, the other is a spare. I tossed the hell out of both of them. He's a neat guy. No weapons, no bombs, no clutter. Nothing under the mattresses. I didn't find anything stronger than Advil in the medicine chest.
He shrugged and turned his attention to the 50s-style kitchen. I watched from the pass-through as he removed the pots and pans from the cabinets, and looked under the range hood and inside the stove, fridge, freezer, and drawers. Everything looked dull and old and normal. I went into the half-bath next to the kitchen. The medicine cabinet had a half-used container of Tums, a pack of razor blades, and a bottle of expired antibiotics. I made note of the doctor's and pharmacist's names, checked the cabinet to see if it was possibly a door to a stash hole. It was not. The trash can held an empty bottle of Listerine, used dental floss, used Q-tips. More work for the crime lab and maybe a lead to DNA in a database. Conklin and I went to the basement with a CSI, who passed an ALS wand over every square foot of the walls and floor, finding no blood or organic trace. After that, we examined the tools, paint cans, canned food on neat wire shelving, but found no secret doors or hidden rooms, or 3D models of the science museum. Overall, my impression of Connor Grant's small, dark house was that the man was bookish, organized, isolated, without a speck of whimsy. There were no weapons, no sign of a woman's presence, nothing to point to Grant being an anarchist or a murderer. And there I was again, still wondering if we'd arrested the wrong man. If Connor Grant had been delusional or a jackass when he told Joe and me that he'd blown up the science museum for artistic expression. I shared that thought with Richie.
Actually, delusional jackass is a definite possibility.
We took a last look around the house, Conklin snapping pictures to take back to Brady and Jacoby, and we left by the back door. Clapper was standing outside waiting for us. He pointed at the wood-frame garage at the end of the driveway adjacent to the house, and at the three-person bomb squad standing outside the roll-up doors. Clapper said,
"Well, my friends, wait till you see this."
Chapter 16. It was almost five when Rich Conklin said to Lindsay,
"I'll call you after the meeting,"
and dropped her at her car in the all-day lot across from the hall. He parked the squad car in front of the building, then headed inside and took the elevator to the fifth floor. Brady was already waiting in Jacoby's corner office.
"We might have found something, Lou," Conklin said.
He had just taken a seat next to Brady on the tufted leather sofa when Chief Jacoby came in, straightening his gray hair with both hands, wincing from an old gunshot injury to his hip as he angled his body and dropped into the chair behind his big cherrywood desk. Jacoby's new assistant, Tony Reynolds, breezed in with her coat buttoned and told Jacoby that Boxer called to say she couldn't make the meeting. "You've got approximately 200 emails, Chief, and too many calls to count. Mostly journalists and TV people. You're going to be famous. Here are the calls and emails I marked urgent." She handed Jacoby a sheet of paper and asked if he needed anything else. "Speak now, otherwise I'm going home to my hubby." When Tony had gone, Jacoby told Conklin and Brady about his day.
"FBI Section Chief Gerson Oliver came here first thing. He's got one objective. If Grant threatened to kill folks, it's domestic terrorism, and the case goes to the FBI. If Grant blew up the big glass building all by himself, as he told Boxer, the case is ours."
Brady and Conklin nodded. Jacoby continued.
"Oliver shared his info, and it's next to nothing. All the FBI could dig up on Grant is job history and some small-town newspaper and internet stories, mainly about science programs he ran in high schools in three states since the time he graduated from the University of Miami in 93. "That's all they've got?"
Conklin said.
"Wait, there's more. After our talk, Oliver and another agent asked Grant for a chat. He agreed, rather happily. They interviewed him for about 4 hours. They did all the talking, with Grant saying, 'I don't know what you're talking about, and I got nothing else to say.' So the feds wanted to take Grant to the bomb site, and I thought, okay, we've got nothing to lose except maybe this giant headache gets handed off to the FBI. I tagged along, hoping the science teacher would show us something, say something."
50 Cent says he didn't say a thing, said Brady.
Jacoby rocked in his chair.
"You're close. He stood in one place and looked around, saying, 'Oh, wow, this is just amazing.' He said several versions of that, like it was an outing and he was happy for the day off."
Jacoby shook his head in disgust.
"Divers are going into the bay tomorrow. The bomb is still missing."
Conklin said,
"Chief, Grant has a chemistry lab in his garage."
Jacoby stopped rocking.
"No shit, really?"
Conklin summarized in a few words what had taken hours to analyze from Grant's Bayview property, and then he homed in on the lab in the garage. Said Conklin,
"It's like what you might see in a high school classroom. One side of the garage has got a sink and shelves of chemicals and all the fixings, beakers, Bunsen burners and microscopes. Some stainless steel equipment, I don't know what to call it. CSI cataloged everything and took samples."
Brady said to Conklin,
"You were about to say something to me when the chief came in."
"Right. I found this inside his lab."
Conklin took out his phone and pulled up a photo of a notebook lying on a stainless steel table. He said,
"This could be a book manuscript."
He read the title out loud.
"How to Make a Bomb." Subtitle says, "For $25 in 25 minutes, and here, lower right corner, by Connor A. Grant."
Conklin walked his phone over to Jacoby, who slapped his hands on his desk and said,
"Thank you, Rich, and thank you, God."
He picked up his desk phone, punched out some numbers.
"Len,"
he said to D.A. Leonard Parisi,
"we've got something useful on the science teacher. Conklin is forwarding a photo to you now."
Chapter 17. After Conklin and I said goodnight in the parking lot, I pulled the car out onto Bryant and made my way to Harrison, then took 10th toward the hospital. Traffic was thick and maddeningly stop and go, but I resisted the urge to hit the siren. The normally 10-minute drive took 20, during which time my mind was flooded with images of Connor Grant, the way he'd looked Thursday night in front of Pier 15. He'd been awestruck, and yet his expression when Brady and I interviewed him this morning had been mocking. Now we had a little more circumstantial evidence against him. His laboratory and his unfunny manuscript on how to build a bomb at home in your spare time for pocket change. It wasn't proof, but it was enough to charge him. At least I thought so. Even if Joe couldn't hear me or answer me, I wanted to tell him all about it, just like I used to do. I turned into the hospital parking area and found an empty spot outside the ER. I took that to be a good sign. I threaded my way through the lobby to the correct elevator bank and reached the ICU without a hitch. I introduced myself to the nurse at the desk and asked how Joe was doing. "We're weaning him off the medication to bring him out of the coma," she said. "It's not a sudden waking up, more like slowly coming back into consciousness. I think he'll know you're here, even if he seems to be out of it." She walked me to the glass-sided stall where Joe lay swaddled in bandages. "I'll be back in a few," she told me. There was no chair, so I stood right next to the bed and looked down at my battered husband. His head was wrapped and tubes ran from somewhere inside his skull, looping under a flap of skin in his neck, and from there emptied into his abdomen. His face was bruised purple. His right forearm was in a cast and his right leg was in traction. He was breathing regularly. He was alive. In my mind, I replayed images of the explosion and the immediate aftermath. The shocking remains of the museum, the body bags lined up on the sidewalk, and the families of the dead and injured both outside the tape and inside the ER waiting room. I was so grateful for Joe's life. I covered his hand with mine. "Joe, it's me, Lindsay. You are doing really well. Dr. Dalrymple is going to put you in a private room tomorrow, with a window and a chair." Joe's eyes fluttered open. Oh my God, he was awake. "Joe!" I squeezed his hand and his fingers moved. Tears ran out of my eyes and dropped onto the sheets.
"What happened?"
he asked me. I hurried to say, "You're okay. Everything's okay." I cleared my throat and, striving for a calm tone, I told him about the explosion, that something had fallen on his head, that he'd had surgery. "Your doctor, Joe, she's great. And you remember that guy who said he set the bomb? We might have evidence against him." Joe closed his eyes and a moment later he opened them and said,
"Sophie. Sophie Fields."
"Joe, it's Lindsay." I flushed. Who was Sophie Fields? A childhood sweetheart whose name had gotten knocked into the present? Maybe she was a partner in one of the clandestine services Joe had worked for. Or was she a current girlfriend? We were living separately, so a girlfriend wasn't actually any of my business, right? Joe had never explained about the mysterious spy, a femme fatale who'd been part of his life and possibly the true root of our split-up. Those raw feelings of betrayal rushed in as I sat with my husband, holding his hand. I didn't like the feelings. Joe didn't owe me an explanation. But why had Sophie Fields been the first name out of his mouth?
"What happened?"
he asked me again. Oh, Joe. Of course, I told him. Again. Chapter 18. When I went to bed on Friday night, my Saturday was well planned. I would sleep late, spend quality time with Julie, take a long nap after lunch, and go to the hospital to see Joe. Then my phone rang at 5 a.m. Jacoby saying,
"Boxer, it's me. A number of tips have come in regarding the GAR video, and you're on deck with the task force."
"The video?" I asked. My voice was gravelly and my eyes were glued shut with sleep.
"The GAR video, Boxer. The one taking credit for Cytron. Overnight, there was internet chatter of the 'yay, we freaking did it' and posted it on Facebook variety. The feds traced the video to an IP address with a physical address in Ingleside."
"No kidding. This is for real?"
"Let's hope so. There are four men living at the address I've just texted you. On the face of it, looks like a self-radicalized terror cell. They have no record, federal or otherwise, so for now, they're ours.
Martha got up, circled a couple of times, dropped back to the bed with her tail over her nose. Lucky dog. Jacoby was saying,
SWAT has federal warrants and orders to secure the premises. Niles is commander. He and the TAC team will meet you and Conklin in Ingleside. Three of our teams in the task force unit are on the way. Boxer, your point man. Get up. Get dressed.
I said, yes, boss. I blinked at the clock with its second hand audibly clicking around the dial. I was thinking that being on this task force had exposed me to a high probability of bombs. I had only just gotten over the car bomb brought to us by the letter J when Citron blew up exactly 36 hours ago. I had a new, heightened reaction to sharp, unexpected sounds. Door slams, for instance, or a glass clattering in the sink doubled my pulse rate. I wanted to say to Jacoby, look, my husband is in the ICU. I have a baby. I've done enough. But Joe's famous punchline came into my mind. Country first. Jacoby said,
Boxer, you there?
I grunted and swung my legs over the bed. He was still talking.
I sent you some background on these men. Be careful.
With gross misgivings, I phoned Mrs. Rose and begged her for the favor of helping me do my job for the USA. Part of me wanted her to say no. Conklin arrived outside my door in his Bronco at 5:20. I had brought bottled water for two, as well as my charged phone and my Kevlar vest, which was zipped up and ready to go. If I'd had a lucky rabbit's foot, I would have brought that, but Julie's finger puppet of Hello Kitty would have to do. I had tucked the puppet into my shirt pocket under my vest, silently promising her I would bring it home by dinner time. There was a coffee container with my name on it in the beverage holder. I tasted it. It was hot. Three sugars. Just the way I like it. You're a good pal, I said to Conklin.
None better,
he said, cracking his famously great grin. I gave his arm a little shove, and then as I strapped in, Rich set course for Ingleside, 6 miles away. Our task force had a dedicated radio channel, and one after the other, the three squad cars in our team checked in with their current locations. One team was from narcotics, another from robbery, one from vice. Conklin and I knew these cops and had worked with them all. As my partner drove us south on Route 1, we talked over our assignment in shorthand snippets. We were facing something that might turn out to be as easy as calling your dog, or it could be a hellacious firefight. DHS said that shutting down this cell had to be done. By the time we got to Ingleside, we had our firefight faces on, and were ready to do whatever it took to end this clear and present danger. Chapter 19. For most of my life, Ingleside had been a drive-through, working and middle-class community on the way to the beach. Now, like the rest of San Francisco, it was gentrifying above the middle-class ability to buy. At 5:30 a.m., streetlights lit Ocean Avenue, the main artery of the business district, which had light rail tracks down the center of the road. There was very little traffic and no cars at all in the parking lot behind Bank of America. We pulled in, and the SFPD squad cars arrived right behind us. Car doors opened and thunked closed, and we greeted one another, gathered around the hood of Conklin's Bronco, where we discussed our briefing. Namely, that the video purportedly produced and disseminated by GAR had been tracked to a group or cell of four young men living here in Ingleside, not far from the SFSU campus. These young men, who ranged in age from 20 to 24, were renting a house that had once been their frat house, now banned from the school because of an alcohol-related death not attributed to these four. Jacoby had sent photos of the men in alphabetical order to our phones. We checked out the suspects. Neil Elverson, who had been three-quarters of the way through a degree in chemistry before flunking out his senior year. Bruce McConnell, a theater major. Mac Travers, who had a bachelor's in political science. And Andrew Yang, who was a computer science whiz. They looked like kids. Regular, cute kids who, when combined, happened to have a powerful skill set that could be used to disrupt and terrorize and kill. Individually, they had a history of posting angry screeds and radical comments on anti-government message boards. Until a few hours ago, nothing any of the four had said or done was illegal. They hadn't threatened attacks. They were on no watch lists. However, when one or more of them posted a video as Gar and took credit for an explosion that had killed 25 people, they crossed the line. The Gar video had gone supernova overnight, accruing millions of hits on all social media. It was not a stretch to say that the kids we were going after this morning fit the profile of self-radicalized, homegrown terrorists to a T. Had this group of angry former frat boys been instrumental in blowing up Psytron? Were they affiliated with Connor Grant? If so, had they been the planners and Grant the doer? Or were these four young men, exactly the type Gar recruited, angry, disaffected young men, depressed or disappointed or both, armed and looking for glory in this life and the next? My attention was drawn to two camouflage green assault vehicles, as sturdy as tanks, that entered the parking lot and stopped. A man got out of one of the vehicles. He was tall, wearing tack gear from head to toe, and had the bearing of a man who'd been in the military for most of his life. He came toward me, calling my name. We shook hands, and I introduced SWAT Commander William Niles, a.k.a. Billy Bob Niles, to my seven task force cops, several of whom had worked with him before. We pulled maps up on our phones, and Niles assigned the task force to points around the target as our perimeter. I checked in with Jacoby, and then our caravan pulled out. The sun hadn't yet come up. Conklin asked,
"What are you thinking?"
I shook my head. I didn't want to say I'd been asking myself and God if I would see Julie and Joe again. Chapter 20. Niles's assault vehicle was leading our caravan as we sped up Ocean Avenue at sunup. The military-style vehicles, the train of police cars, couldn't be more inappropriate in this very sweet-looking, all-American neighborhood. Niles pulled to a stop at the intersection of Ocean and Plymouth. I saw the craftsman-style house we were targeting, two doors down from the intersection. It was white stucco with a green roof, sitting on an unmown lawn. An expensive SUV a couple of years old was in the driveway. Plates registered to McCord Travers, one of the presumed terrorists. The house was dark. No lights, and no sign of activity. I called Jacoby.
"Thanks for doing this.
Come home safe," he said.
"Copy that." Per the plan, three cars and our team blocked off the streets around the subject house, forming our perimeter. SWAT poured out of their vehicles and broke into their well-practiced maneuvers, four men covering the back and side doors, four getting into position on either side of the front entrance. Niles pointed to me and then to the Honda SUV in the driveway. Conklin and I left the Bronco and used the Honda as a barrier 20 yards from the front door. On Niles's signal, the TAC team stove in the green door and flashbangs were tossed. Conklin and I took cover behind the Honda as the blinding, deafening grenades went off. I looked up, saw the TAC team storming the house, leaving Rich and me to wait while they cleared the scene. I knew well that the grenades had no shrapnel, were meant only to blind and stun the occupants of the house. But tell that to my startle reflex. I held onto the side of the Honda, shaking like a baby mouse in a cat's paws. This would not do. This would not do at all. I looked over the hood, and beside me, Rich did the same. I heard the word "clear" shouted repeatedly from inside the house as the teams went from room to room and up to the second floor. Only 5 minutes later, Niles came out to the porch and shouted,
"Boxer, we're all clear. You're up."
I said to Rich, "Ready or not, here we go." Chapter 21. Rich and I and the rest of the SFPD counterterrorism task force thundered into the bomb-cleared house. It actually looked as though a bomb had gone off. Clothing and garbage and bedding were strewn everywhere. After a second look, I realized this was not explosive fallout. This was frat house living. Niles called me into a ground-floor bedroom where two of the suspects and a naked woman were rolling around on the bed and floor, crying and moaning. Sergeant Mal Rayner, Vice, cuffed the two males to the bed, and after covering her with a blanket, flex-cuffed the young female by the wrists and took her out to his cage car. The two other boys were in the living room, both on the floor, sobbing and cursing. The flashbang had disabled their equilibrium and scared the hell out of them, making this a good time to separate and question them. Conklin took the one who appeared to be Elverson, the former chem major, and I grabbed Yang, the computer guy, and set him down in a tattered chair. His nose was running. His eyes were red. He looked pitiful. I said, Mr. Yang, you're under arrest.
What did I do?
I said, you're under arrest for threatening communications.
What? What is that?
For putting out a terror message. It's a federal offense.
I didn't do anything like that. You're crazy.
Mr. Yang, listen to me before you start claiming your innocence. I'm Sergeant Boxer. I am with the SFPD working with Homeland Security. I'm arresting you for blowing up Psytron.
What?
Or for saying you did. That's threatening communications, specifically disseminating the video claiming credit for the GAR attack on Psytron.
I didn't...
That video has been traced to a computer inside this house. That's why I'm reading you your rights. This 22-year-old was watching and listening, but from the look in his eyes, I couldn't be sure that he was following me. I called out to Inspector Ronnie Burke, a good guy in robbery I'd known for a couple of years, and asked him to witness my conversation with Andrew Yang while I recorded it on my phone. I wasn't repeating the Connor Grant confession, no confession error twice. Burke leaned against the wall and I showed Yang my phone. I pressed record. I said my name and the date, time, and address, and then said, Andrew Yang, you have the right to remain silent. Do you understand? He said,
Say it again.
I complied, and then, Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand? After I took him through his rights and he answered that he understood them, I asked him to tell me what part he'd had in the bombing of Psytron. He shook his head no, while casting his eyes toward Neil Elverson, who was being half-dragged out of the house in cuffs. Please take me seriously, Andrew. One of your friends, or maybe that young lady, is going to cut a deal with the police and confess to this crime in exchange for lighter time. If I were your mother, I'd tell you that the one who talks first wins. You should listen to me. I'm telling you the truth. Chapter 22. Dylan Mitchell was a fit, 52-year-old internet cult figure, operating as a member of GAR, who went by the name Hate. He lived in and podcast from a former bicycle factory in Dogpatch, a neighborhood on the eastern shore of San Francisco. The open space building had a tin ceiling and 20-foot-high walls, with a catwalk halfway up the walls that wrapped around three sides. At one end was a computer studio, which was where he was sitting now. Powerful industrial ceiling fans blew a benign breeze over the platform bed on wheels and the wide plank floors below. Haight was frugal. He dressed simply in loose clothing and kept his possessions to a minimum. But when it came to electronics, he had the best. He accepted donations to keep himself alive, which freed him to put his energy into producing his podcasts and posting the videos and protest speeches that he'd archived from the 60s and 70s, beginning with those his mother had given before he was born. Haight, a.k.a. the red-headed stepchild of the 60s revolution, was the son of Aaron Mitchell, a famously brave extremist who had founded Youth for a Democratic Society, a group of radicals that had forever shifted the consciousness of a complacent America. Haight had never discovered the identity of his father unknown. Mama had told him at various times that his father might be Jerry Rubin or Jerry Garcia or even Bob Dylan. She never swore to the truth of his paternity, but it was probably because she didn't know. By the time she died of ovarian cancer, Haight no longer cared who his father was. He had formed his own ideology, and his manifesto was online worldwide. Haight drafted alongside the GAR movement. He believed what they believed, but his methods were hands-off. He didn't recruit. He wasn't a technical advisor. He was a spokesman for the overturn of corrupt governments, and he spoke of revolution. He believed that all politics should be local and fully participatory. This left him both anti-state and anti-corporate. His major demons were the U.S. government, the West in general, the IMF, Big Oil, Wall Street, central banks, and the various U.S. bloodsucking cartels, defense, big pharma, agribusiness, and higher education. Along with Gar, he was inspiring the lone wolves and stray dog rebels, the angry underclass around the world yearning to break free. His podcasts were reports from the new front of terror without borders that was breaking out all over the world. Violence was a way of cleansing humanity of its statist and corporatist sins and ushering in a new world in much the same way the Russian Bolsheviks did. It boiled down to an old slogan, simple and moving. Power to the people. He was also Machiavellian, and he knew it. Any means to the correct end. Hate was active in many twisting corridors on the dark web. He gathered and disseminated news from the underground and produced his own commentary. People wrote to Hate. He didn't write back, but through an encrypted app, he could pop into friendly computer stations at will, and so his friends could talk to him anytime. And they did. Jay had chatted with him before he set off for his sadly failed mission at SFO. Still, Jay had made his mark and, in doing so, had fueled the revolution. This morning, Hate was sipping his homemade peppermint leaf tea while browsing the open transmissions from web friends, donors, and acolytes when his monitor went sharp white, accompanied by two consecutive booms that shocked the high right out of him. What had to have been an explosion had come from the house rented by the four in Ingleside. When the picture cleared, he was looking at Andy Yang's face as a woman cop with a ponytail shouted, "Mr. Yang, wake up! This is the police!" Hate watched what he could see of an emergency response team sweep through the house in Ingleside. Then he disconnected from the net. He thought about those kids for a few minutes. They knew nothing about him that wasn't common knowledge. He had a law degree from Columbia. He exercised his free speech rights, knowing how to keep himself safe from complicity in acts of treason. Hate selected a favorite album from his playlist, L.A. Woman, The Doors, 1971, and turned on the speakers. He stepped into a pair of sandals and took the spiral staircase to the roof deck. There he turned on the hose, and as he watered the tomatoes, he sang Riders on the Storm along with Jim Morrison. And he pictured those brave kids in Ingleside. He looked forward to a time when all people would be free. Chapter 23. That morning, Yuki went to the third floor of the hall and checked in with Marie Fenucci, D.A. Len Parisi's personal gatekeeper. She took one of the chairs in a row along the wall and waited to be called. As she sat there, ADAs came one after the other into Len's area. Some paced like soon-to-be fathers with wives in the delivery room. Others stood, pensive, avoiding eye contact with everyone until the previous ADA left, and Marie told the next in line to go right in. 5 minutes later, the ADA would leave Len's office at a smart pace, eyes straight ahead, mind clearly on the case at hand. Yuki found it disorienting, both familiar and strange, to revisit a past that she'd thought was securely behind her. Yesterday, while she was driving home from work, Len had called. She let the call go through to voicemail, then thumbed the keys until it played back.
Yuki? It's Len. Parisi. Yuki, I have to talk to you. Call me.
He left his cell and home numbers. Having worked under Len Parisi for 4 years, Yuki had to fight her powerful reflex to call him right back. She thought about how much she had loved working for Len, prosecuting bad guys, becoming an ace litigator in the nuclear-charged atmosphere of the DA's office. Then, a year ago, after a near-death experience, Yuki had a change of heart and mind about her career with the DA. She wanted to give back, use her skills to do good works for less fortunate people who couldn't afford a lawyer. She expected Len to understand, but she misgauged his attachment to her. She was his protege, and he didn't take her resignation well. In one short meeting, she lost him as a boss, as a mentor, and as a friend. That had hurt. Bad. It had been a year since she took the job with the not-for-profit Defense League, and she hadn't spoken with Len in that time. What could he possibly want to discuss with her now? She pulled off Highway 92 onto an overlook and hit return call. She pressed her phone hard to her ear and listened to it ring. Then Parisi was on the line.
Yuki?
Len?
They exchanged a very short volley of awkward pleasantries, after which Parisi got to the point.
We have a suspect under arrest on the Cytron bombing.
I heard. The science teacher.
I need a lead ADA who thinks like I do to work with me on the trial. Look, Yuki, will you come back? I need you. The city needs you. Tell me what you want, and I'll break down doors to get it for you. How's that for an easy-breezy negotiation?
Pro? Len was going to make her lead ADA, second chair to him on this enormous and very important trial. Con? It was going to be unrelenting, exhausting work. There were so many victims and intense public scrutiny and everything at once. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Bottom line, it would be a return to a life not her own. This morning, as she waited in the hectic area outside Len's office, Yuki silently continued to debate the possible outcomes of this meeting. After hearing Len out, would she be even more determined to stay in her job at the Not-for-Profit Defense League? Or was helping Len Parisi put a mass murderer away just too challenging an opportunity to turn down? The frosted glass panel office door opened, and the large, rough-looking man came toward her. She stretched out her hand to shake his, and he bent to her, hugging her so hard that her feet almost left the ground.
So good to see you, Yuki, said Len. Please come home.
Chapter 24 3 days after we pulled in the Ingleside Four, they were arraigned and remanded to a federal jail, awaiting their hearing by a grand jury. Their video taking responsibility as Gar had been seen throughout the USA, and therefore their crime of threatening communications was the first charge against them and enough to hold them during further investigation. Now all four were fully in the hands of the federal judicial system, and not in ours at all. Several rough versions of the Gar video had been filed in a folder on Yang's computer, but to date the government techs had found nothing about explosives on any of the kids' computers. Red Dog Parisi saw nothing to indicate that those kids had actually been involved in the Cytron bombing, but he felt otherwise about Connor Grant. Yuki was waiting for me at McBain's, the designated Hall of Justice watering hole conveniently located across Bryant and down the street, wedged between two bail bondsmen's storefronts. As usual, the homey bar and grill was loud, and customers had packed it to the walls. We hugged, pulled our chairs up to the little table at the front of the room. She looked beautiful. Her straight, dark, shoulder-length hair with a blue streak in front framed her face. She was wearing a perfect size 2 midnight blue designer suit with excellent accessories. Best of all, she was beaming. How'd it go with Red Dog? I asked, referring to her meeting 3 days ago with San Francisco's larger-than-life, red-haired, no-holds-barred district attorney.
I'm back on the city payroll, she said, with a 2% increase, and they gave me a one-time exemption. My benefits are restored. Plus, I get reimbursed for overtime parking and 2 full weeks of vacation, circumstances permitting.
I laughed along with her. So, no vacation, right?
I pretty much got my old work till you drop job back.
We ordered BLTs with steak fries and near beer, and then Yuki got into it.
We've got an arraignment in Judge Rabinowitz's court tomorrow at 3, Yuki told me. I've got some paperwork from Parisi, but you were the arresting officer. Tell me everything.
Lunch was served. Yuki ate, and I just talked and talked. She was not just my friend and member in good standing in the Women's Murder Club. She was responsible now for getting Connor Grant officially charged and remanded without bail. I told Yuki that I didn't even want to think of him getting bail and walking free. And then I told her everything else, including date night at the Crested Cormorant, the sunset-lit explosion, the arrest of the bizarre Mr. Grant, quoting his comments to me in front of Pier 15. And I answered her questions about the evidence we had found in his house. CSI is still hacking into his computer, but apparently he has all kinds of hack blockers in place. Conklin and I are going through reams of school papers he thoughtfully boxed up and stored in his lab, I told her. The FBI checked him out. As Grant says, he's been a science teacher for over 20 years. He's been written about in local papers for his science projects, etc., but this unpublished how-to book was all we found related to bombs. I asked, "You think this book could give you enough to make the charges stick?"
"I'm going to reserve my opinion until I see the book."
We finished lunch, returned to the hall, and went directly to the property room, where Yuki checked out Connor Grant's manuscript on how to build a bomb cheap, fast, and well.
"It's not proof of anything, but it goes to intent," she said cautiously.
I had hoped for more enthusiasm, but Yuki was right to have low expectations. The manuscript was circumstantial at best. Yuki said,
"The book might incriminate him, but we need Joe's testimony to corroborate Grant's confession. That's critical. But even that doesn't guarantee a slam-dunk conviction."
Joe was no longer comatose, but his consciousness was impaired. It was impossible to know what he would recall when or if he recovered from his traumatic head injury. Yuki and I talked about Grant's computer, our hope that the explosive material in Grant's house would be found at the bomb site. Then we split up. She went down one floor to Len's office, and I worked with Richie in the squad room for the rest of the day. We were thorough, but slogging through half of Connor Grant's 100-plus boxes of tests and term papers was exhausting and fruitless. When the day was finally done, I called home and spoke to my little Julie and my dear, life-saving Mrs. Rose. Then I drove to the hospital. Joe had a new room with a chair and a window and a whole lot of flowers. I taped an abstract crayon drawing to the window, signed by the almost 2-year-old artist in residence on Lake Street. I told Joe about Yuki and Grant's arraignment, and then I watched TV in Joe's room for about an hour. He never opened his eyes, and he never spoke a word about Sophie Fields, me, Julie, or anyone else. He slept. Chapter 25. Conklin and I sat in the back row of Judge Stephen Rabinowitz's arraignment courtroom in the San Francisco Superior Court, located on the second floor of the Hall of Justice. We were there to support Yuki and to see for ourselves that Connor Grant's attorney didn't Houdini him out of our jail with a low bail. The blonde wood-paneled courtroom was standing room only. The victims' families filled the rows, wanting to see the killer in the flesh and to help the judge understand the depth of their horror and loss. Yuki was ready when Connor Grant's case was called, and his lawyer walked him to the bench. Grant turned to look at the gallery full of people. I don't think he saw me, but I got a look at him. A man who had spent 5 full days in jail, sleeping with his eyes open, standing with his back to the wall. He wore a classic orange jumpsuit, clanking bracelets and shackles, and a chain belt hooking all his metallic restraints together. I had met his attorney, Elise Antonelli, a $400-an-hour lawyer who, my guess, had taken this appalling case because of the career-building opportunities in criminal defense. She was about 5'2", fair-skinned and brown-eyed, and she had an easy smile. She was also sharp and, in my opinion, eager to join the battle. The charges were read, 25 counts of murder 2, and the deceased were named in alphabetical order. Every time a name was read, someone in the room moaned or cried out. Judge Rabinowitz threatened to clear the courtroom. I thought he didn't want to do that, but he would if the spectators in the gallery got out of hand. Rabinowitz asked Grant,
"Do you understand the charges against you?"
Connor Grant said,
"Do I understand them?"
I sucked in my breath. What was the psycho killer going to say?
"No, I don't understand them," he said. "I was a passerby when Citron was detonated. I was a very unlucky passerby, Your Honor. I didn't have anything to do with that bombing."
Rabinowitz said,
"Let me rephrase the question, Mr. Grant. Do you understand that you are being charged with 25 counts of murder in the second degree?"
"Well, I heard the charges."
"Good. How do you plead?"
"Not guilty 25 times.
Antonelli spoke up.
"Your Honor, we ask that the charges against Connor Grant be dismissed. He had nothing whatsoever to do with bombing Citron and therefore nothing to do with these tragic deaths."
Yuki said,
"Your Honor, Mr. Grant confessed at the scene to Sergeant Lindsay Boxer of the SFPD Homicide Division and her husband, Joseph Molinari, who was injured in the secondary blast. We have bomb-making materials taken into evidence by crime scene investigation from Mr. Grant's premises. These materials, plus written materials in the defendant's handwriting, go to show that Mr. Grant, a science teacher, is quite knowledgeable in the making of explosives. He also had the means and the opportunity to set off this blast.
Rabinowitz said,
"Let's talk about bail, Ms. Castellano."
"We request that bail be denied and that Mr. Grant be remanded to the maximum security jail in the Hall of Justice."
The judge said,
"Ms. Antonelli?"
"Mr. Grant is a law-abiding citizen with strong ties to the community, Your Honor. He is gainfully employed by St. Brendan High School. He has no prior charges, nothing so much as a littering ticket in his life, and the evidence against him is completely based in police mistakes and hysteria. Furthermore, Mr. Grant has no passport and is not a flight risk."
Judge Rabinowitz glanced at Yuki, then at Antonelli. Last, he gave Connor Grant a good, long look.
"Bail denied," said Rabinowitz. "Defendant is remanded to the custody of the court."
Bam.
It was clear to me what the judge had been thinking when he denied bail. A suspected terrorist was in custody, a man who had possibly killed 25 people, and if he was released and then disappeared, this one decision would be the only act Judge Rabinowitz would be known for. It would be paragraph 2 in his obituary. It would probably be chiseled on his headstone. As his gavel slammed down, two court officers came forward and escorted Connor Grant out of the courtroom through the side exit that led into the back stairs, which were restricted to courthouse personnel. As they reached the door, there was a struggle. Conklin and I were on our feet, hands to our guns. But Grant wasn't trying to make a break for freedom. He turned to face the judge and shouted, "I'm being framed. I have a life, and I want it back. I demand a speedy trial. That is my right. Short date, Your Honor." The judge said to the court officers,
"Please remove the defendant from the courtroom."
We waited for Yuki out in the hallway as the bomb victims' friends and families blew through the double doors. When the room was nearly empty, Yuki stepped into the corridor. "Great job," I said to my friend.
"Terrific," said Richie. "You were brilliant."
"I felt like myself," said Yuki.
She looked surprised when she said,
"It's good to be back."
Chapter 26. Claire called the next morning as Conklin and I were going through ninth grade science classwork on Earth and life sciences.
"Lindsay," Claire said, "I got some info on that dead lady who came in with the bomb victims. You know who I mean? Presumed heart attack, but she had a needle mark in her posterior."
"I remember. Puncture mark and a small bruise."
"Correct," said Claire. "Come on down."
"I'll be right there," I said. I pulled on my jacket and said to my partner, "Be back in a few."
"I know what you're doing, you know."
"Guilty of leaving you with dead dinosaurs, Inspector. I'll be back in 10 minutes. Want to come with?"
He glared.
"You go," he said. "You two have fun."
I grinned at him, and then I took off. Claire was waiting for me in the reception area. We walked back to her office, and she opened a folder and spread 8x10 morgue photos across her desk.
"Meet Ms. Lois Sprague," she said. "I finally had a minute to do a real thorough search for her, and guess what? Found her in a Washington State missing persons database. She was reported missing 2 days after Citron. I took the liberty of calling the Spokane police, and I have some information."
"Shoot," I said, sitting down. I looked at the morgue photos of the dead woman, and she was as Claire had described. White, 40, caramel-colored hair, well-nourished, lacerations and abrasions on her legs from having been clipped by a car. And she had a round bruise the size of a half dollar on her right buttock. Claire said, "What I learned from Spokane PD is that Ms. Sprague was single, in private practice as a family lawyer. Her sister told the police that Lois was a workaholic, had social anxiety, and a few cats. That's the worst that could be said of her."
"No enemies?"
"According to the sister, Lois was a peacemaker. No one threatened or stalked her. She was on vacation and had no friends here."
It was a solo trip, a week-long change-of-scene-type vacation.
So what killed her?
Claire went on. Like I told you, I put a rush on the tox screen, she said, and no drugs were found in her body. But you know, Lindsay, there are drugs that leave the system quickly. If you're not on it fast and not looking specifically for that drug, you may not find a trace of it. I can't put on the death certificate that I'm 100% certain that Lois Sprague was murdered, but in my opinion, it's the only possible cause of death. Remember I told you I'd seen something like this 2 months ago? Presumed heart attack? I chased down the death certificate and morgue photos of Anthony George, cab driver, wife.